Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Space Game Junkie Podcast. I, as always, am your co-host, Brian, and joining me, as always, is your co-host, Jim.
There is no Jim, only Zool.
I haven't seen that movie in so long. And your co-host, Hunter.
Greetings, Starfighter.
Now, that movie, I just saw maybe a month or two ago.
Did you watch the Blu-ray?
Yes. Yeah, the Blu-ray looks pretty nice.
Yeah, it does make an, like, you can see very clearly how primitive the graphics were back then. But
that's no one's fault, you know.
No, no, I mean, it's a certain charm, and I like the Star Car.
Oh, the Star Car, yes. is my favorite car. I still want one. I still honestly want one.
Welcome to Rylos, my boy.
Oh, Centauri. We have a guest this week, my friend. Robert Preston. We do have a guest this week joining us all the way from Perth in Australia. Apparently it's the LA of Australia, if LA was stuck in the 50s. Paul Turbitt, lead developer at Black Lab Games. Welcome, Paul.
All right, thank you for having me on.
And I think, if I'm remembering correctly, you might be our sixth Paul that we've had on.
There is a lot of Pauls. We have a Paul gallery.
We do have a lot of Pauls. That's not a bad thing. It's just a little factoid I want to throw out there. So we are here to talk about your game, Starhammer: The Vanguard Prophecy, which is actually the second game in the Starhammer series, humorously enough. Yeah. So I wanted to talk about the first game real quick because I have to admit I haven't played it, and I'm sorry. What the heck was that? But Starhammer Tactics, it wasn't just a mobile game. It did come out on the PC. That looked more like a top-down, just strictly 2D thing. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty correct. Yeah, it came out on a number of platforms, actually. The first one it came out on was Xbox Live Indie Games.
Oh, okay.
And then after that, it got moved over onto the PSP. It was released as a PSP Mini.
Right.
And that was just a 2D top-down, really simplified strategy game. So I think the design goal with that one was to try and make a really simple, almost casual kind of strategy game. Then we kind of thought, oh, that might work on iPad, so we moved it across to iPad, did a major upgrade to the graphics and released that, and then put it onto PC and released it on PC as well. So moved across a number of different platforms.
So I have a question about that. We're just right off the bat. So when you change platforms that much, so like with Xbox Live, I would assume you had to build it with XNA. And then whenever you switch over into PSP, I have no idea what they do. And then iPad, of course, would be whatever that C is that they use on Apple. I can't remember. Objective-C. And Cocoa, I guess. I don't know. I've not written anything for iPad, but you know, I've seen some Mac development stuff. So how much challenge is there in that? You know, you have essentially the complete game, but then it has to drop into a completely different framework. So how much porting is that?
So basically, the game was written three times, pretty much. The first time, like you said, it was done in XNA, which was a pretty simple and straightforward process. On the PSP, it's all custom proprietary Sony libraries. So it was obviously all the graphics was reused, but the code was pretty much rewritten. Then when we brought it across to iPad and PC, it was done in Unity 3D. So again, that was another rewrite. So I mean, you can take some of the parts and reuse them, but
yeah. Well, once the game was once you're in time. Unity, you've arrived though, because you can hit a button and dump it out for any platform. So
That's pretty true, yeah.
Is that where you stayed with the new game? Just do it in Unity?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I think at the time, Unity was only on, well, a little bit on mobile, but I don't think it was on, or it's never been on PSP, I think it's on Vita now. And it wasn't on Xbox at the time, so it probably wasn't an option. But, yeah, I've been using Unity since like 2008, so I'm pretty familiar with it, and it's definitely my preferred platform, so, yeah. So, yeah, the new game is all in Unity 5.
Oh man, you know what sucks? I just looked it up. I was like, wait, this is on the PSP. Why don't I own this on my Vita? It's not available for the Vita. Only the PSP and the PS3. Which is
Well, I think it runs on Vita as well in the emulation mode, but that might have changed. I'm not sure. It's like 4 or 5 years ago since it was released. So I don't know what the deal is with that now.
Know what? I'm gonna give it a shot because I mean, I have a PS3. I could play it on that, but I mean, I have a Vita. I mean, PSP games can usually be played on a Vita. Usually.
Yeah. So I see. I'm looking on the. On your page, and I see one of the screenshots here is like an isometric view. Is that what the PC currently is, or that which platform is that?
Yeah. So what happened was with the two console versions were strictly 2D top down. When we went into Unity, which means the iPad version, PC version, we redid the art, so it was 3D. But initially, when you're playing your moves, you're looking from top down. And then when you get into a combat situation, it switches to a sort of isometric view and sort of visualizes the battle between the two enemies, just to make it a bit more interesting and exciting for it to look at. And I guess that's kind of a little bit of where the direction for Starhammer Vanguard proxy went, where you do your moves and then everything executes, and it's a combination of that sort of tactical planning, take my time, work out what I want to do. Yeah. Then visualize the way that's more exciting and interesting and looks good.
Yeah, that whole WeGo system is...
I love it.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing about the game, really.
Love it.
Essentially, what you've made in that is the tabletop miniatures starship combat game that I've always wanted on a PC. And, so it's like, I hope that engine, you know, it's if you could bring that to, like, anything else, right? That's spaceships, you know, like big fleets doing that. That would be really cool. Even as a combat portion of a larger game that, you know, like let's say if you did a 4X, that could be the combat resolution for it, and I would be perfectly happy with that.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. I guess the miniatures comparison you made there was something that we were aiming for. So I'm kind of glad to hear that we've done that reasonably well.
It's too bad they won't hand you the Star Trek license because I could see some things happening.
Oh man. Now it reminds me of a couple of old Avalon Hill PC games I played back in the 90s called Over the Reich and Achtung Spitfire. And there's an explanation at the end.
Did they do a WeGo like that as well?
Yes. That's exactly what it was. It was turn-based tactical air combat. And you moved the ships, you know, you moved them based on their throttle and everything where they could. And then you'd watch it, like, unfold. And then you'd move them again. So it's very similar to this. Did you play that, Paul? Did you play this?
I was going to say, like, those ones, no, I never actually saw those ones myself. I did have, when we were doing the beta, though, we did have people that brought up the comparison with that Achtung Spitfire game. So you're not the first ones to say that.
Yeah, those are...
The first game I ever played that did WeGo like that was Combat Mission.
I knew you were going to say Combat Mission. That's the first game a lot of people played that did a WeGo system like this.
Yeah, and I from the first moment that I played it, I have prayed that there would be some sort of a Mech Warrior game that would also use a WeGo system, but it has never emerged.
So that would be great. Oh, that would be so awesome.
Like, it's definitely a lot of potential. You do anything with it.
Oh yeah, no, there's a ton of potential with this engine. Like, just the different planes. So you actually kind of have 3D a little bit. Like, people were asking me, is it 3D like Homeworld? I'm like, well, it's 3D, but not really like Homeworld. Just a little different.
Well, I actually wish kind of that Homeworld was more like.
I agree.
You know, because here it's just different altitudes that you're at. But with Homeworld, it's a little more janky in the controls, right? Because just the way that you have to. By the way, I bought a copy of Homeworld for Joan, so I'm going to kind of go through that of how you plot position in 3D like that, because it's definitely not easy to do.
Here, it's much more manageable.
Yeah, exactly.
It's much more manageable.
I kind of like the Homeworld 3D, though. I like this one as well, but I don't know. Maybe I'm just used to the Homeworld's way of doing
You're biased, Hunter. You're really, biased.
There's a slight biasism there, but I'm just saying, like, I'm used to the controls.
Just a slight bias. Just a slight bias.
Get out of here.
Yeah, I can. It's my show.
No, Jim and I are taking over. Corporate takeover.
No, like hell. It's a coup. Space game coup. I gotta say, when you first look at it, when you first look at where you can move your ships and everything, the brain might think, oh, this isn't very flexible at all. I can only do this and this. But as you play, you're like, no, wait a minute. This is super flexible. I could do all these things. You know, I could move him up and have him go over here and make him do a tight turn because he's got a side firing arc and have him go over here. And I kind of love that. I love how tactical this game is. You guys have done just a tremendous job of making just this. Just the tactics just feel real, feel encompassing.
Yeah, no, that's good. We did spend a lot of time on those kind of things, and we did try a lot of different things to try and make that work as well. It took us quite a few goes. You look at it like you said before, and it feels pretty simple, and making it so that it's like really approachable, and people can immediately start doing the basics. And then being able to expand on that, like you say, and have all these different options based on this ship can do that one if I use this capability over here and so on. It does take a while to get those to work and to make them, have that variety of options and so on. So yeah, it took us quite a while to get that up and running.
And I kind of love how you could probably win a battle if you didn't tweak your shields and you didn't tweak your power, but you can if you want to. And that is really nice. And I have to say, any game that has a power triangle, I'm a fan of. Like Independence War, Starpoint Gemini 2, this, for example. I love the power triangle. So when I first saw that, I was like, whoo!
Yay! Technically, Elite Dangerous has it too.
It's a little different in Elite Dangerous. That's more of like the X-Wing style of like the pips.
It's like a power management, though, but still.
Yeah, it's still power management, but I don't know, something about the visualization of the power triangle, I just love that. Yeah.
Now, works for me. There's something about this that I really like. Of course, it's the key feature of the game is this like slow turn-based style of gameplay, and it kind of reminds me of the Star Wars tabletop Armada, Star Wars Armada.
Yep.
Which is very tactical and strategy, and you gotta like plan things out because you could start turning one way and it would actually be the wrong thing to do, and then you're kind of screwed. Mm-hmm. But that brings up, is there gonna be potential for multiplayer down the road?
Yeah, everyone's asking about that at the moment.
I bet.
Everyone's asking about that at the moment. I guess what I would say is that, we are definitely looking into it. I can't guarantee anything right at this point in time.
Right.
Something we're definitely very keen on looking into for sure. Mm.
So the one thing that I would like that maybe is easy to get in is, depending on how your AI works, but I understand coming from the first game where you were fighting the space critters, and now in this one, because the Nautilids, which are essentially space shrimp looking things, right?
space crustaceans.
Well, what the first thing that I thought was, Brian, what was that game that we played, the multiplayer thing, Jumpgate? Right, because it's got the big purple space squids.
Oh yes,
or
Jumpgate.
Pink space squids.
Oh my god, what are they called? The Conflux.
Yeah.
Yes.
They're big pink space octopus things.
Yeah,
right?
Pretty much.
So,
yeah.
So I saw this and I was like, oh, okay. You know, it's kind of like that. It's an organic enemy that, you know, somehow has evolved to like survive in space like that. But there's just a part of me, like, I wish that there was two campaigns and because it's a little bit interwoven, right? Because there's like some pirates and stuff that you fight, but then it turns basically to fighting the Nautilids. And I wish that there was a campaign where it was just my spaceships fighting other similar spaceships, and or if I could do that in the just in the skirmish thing, because I went into the skirmish and it makes me set up Nautilids, and I don't have a choice, so. Yeah. I guess that would satisfy that urge enough right there, is if I could just go in and say, just give me some, you know, random fleet of ships just like mine to fight.
I guess we're sort of looking into all those kind of options about what to do now that we've sort of got the first version out there. Taking a lot of sort of feedback from Steam forums and so on. Obviously pretty keen to hear what people have to say and what they... what they like and where we could go from here. It's definitely a game that we kind of feel that it's not done in any way, shape or form. Like where it is at the moment is a starting point. Obviously it's a finished product. It's not like an early access thing where we're just chucking it out there and hoping for the best. I mean, it is a finished product.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're definitely keen to see, what people like and what they want to see going forward so we can update it and improve it and, give people the opportunities for those, massive battles and stuff that they want to have. So, we're excited about that.
Have you gotten any comparison remarks about your game and Starlight Tactics? Because it's,
I think I've seen that somewhere. Yeah.
At first glance, they look kind of similar. Because it's that's also a turn based. But it's a little bit more like Battle Fleet. Where you actually have to plot the turret shots off the ships at each other and such. So, and it's not so much a WeGo thing. It's strictly a turn-based. But to just look at a screenshot, it's, it's like isometric 3D spaceship on a map kind of thing. So.
I do definitely, I know what you're saying. And I think I've had one or two comparisons, but not many. The main one we're getting is to that, to the Star Wars Armada, to the tabletop game. I've definitely seen that a lot more, which is very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's actually having an effect on me in the opposite direction, right? It's like, people that liked Armada would like this. Well, it's like, I like this, so maybe I need to look at Armada because I keep hearing the comparison. So, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Now, one thing I like is the skirmish mode where you can play around and kind of make... little skirmishes. Is there going to be because I'm sure people would love some kind of map or campaign editor where they can make their own maps and campaigns. Is that something you guys might add?
It's definitely a possibility. I guess all those things are kind of open for discussion at the moment. I mean, the game's only been out for a couple of weeks, so we haven't really sort of nailed down exactly what we're doing yet. I think definitely, it would be pretty achievable. Wouldn't be a tough thing to do. There's a possibility.
Okay. So the other thing, cause I was asking about the first game, right? And I see you're selling it on the store for $4.99. So now that, did you go through Greenlight on this one?
We had it on Greenlight for a while, but we've taken it off for now. Just the reason being that we don't want to kind of, confuse the focus between two different games with similar names.
Oh, okay.
That's fair.
Well, I mean the current game, the Vanguard game, did that go through Greenlight to get onto Steam, or were you just admitted on?
We're working with Slytherin, who's the publisher of this.
Oh, okay. That explains it. Yeah.
So they don't.
Okay, because I was going to say, if you went through Greenlight, once you get one game in, you can gate other games in through. But since you're working with Slytherin, that it's a done thing. But so I guess once sales of this game calm down, I would say definitely bring the other one in for sure.
Cool. I think what we'd probably want to do if we were to do that is do a bit of a remastered version. Because the first game, admittedly, the graphics aren't particularly great. It's a bit, it's pretty dated by now. So I think we probably need to have a bit of a look at it and maybe improve some of the game systems and stuff. And that's kind of a bit of a slippery slope because before you know it, you're just completely rewriting it. And what starts out as like a tiny little, with just, you know, make this a little better, ends up being a whole new project and it's been 2 years and, you know, gets a bit out of control. So yeah, we probably don't want to be a good bit of work on it. Cause I don't think it would be where it is at the moment. It's probably not at the level that we would want to put out there given what we just released. So.
Right. But that'd be great if, like, you know, owners of the original, like, got a discount on the new one, and then, like, you sold the new one for a few bucks, you know, because people are clamoring for space games like this.
Yeah. You know?
And one thing I got to say I love about this particular game is, especially because it went through Slytherin and Matrix, is the price point. You're getting a lot of content here for 18, 20 bucks.
Yeah, I think so. I think we actually, I think it's pretty reasonable. To be honest. Yeah,
because that actually makes it easier. Like, because when I really like a game, I will try and sell people on it, and people ask the price, and I tell them. And sometimes, like when I tell people I like Distant Worlds, they're like, "Oh,
yeah," because that's $60. You know, it's shocking to go on Steam and see something that's not, you know, triple A thing.
Yeah. And I try and tell them it's worth it. You get like a billion years of content. It's a desert island game, but nope. But then I tell them about your game and blah, blah, blah. Oh, it's like 18 bucks. Really? Bye. You know, because it's just much more closer to that impulse level.
Yeah. It was 18 for the first week.
Well, it's like 20 bucks. Yeah. Is it on sale right now? Is it on the Steam sale?
No, it was only on sale for the first week.
Yeah, let me see. I just want to. Oh, where did it go? Where'd you go? Hey, what the? I typed in Starhammer in Steam, and it's like, what's going on?
Yeah,
is it hiding stuff I already own? What's going on, man? Steam has been acting a little weird since the sale started. But yeah, I mean, even 20 bucks is still a lot easier to swallow for a lot of people. Was that part of the plan from the beginning to keep it at this like low, easier impulse price point? Or was that something that happened along the way?
I think it kind of happened along the way. Like when you first start out, you really got no idea what you're going to be able to sell something for because you don't really know what you've got until you've, you know, got a fair way towards making it. But I think, Slytherin have a particular audience for all their war games and so on. And I think they're broadening their appeal by going out to like, you know, Steam and staying on the Humble Store, to get more sort of strategy gamers that want maybe a bit more than just the war games, the hardcore war games. So I think if you're trying to broaden your appeal, then you kind of need to, price accordingly. So I guess that's kind of the thinking there is just to make sure that, you know, sort of fitting in with expectations on Steam. So that's what we did.
I think it's a very smart decision, and I hope it's working out. Now, one thing I like, I'm going to switch gears a little bit about the story, because I do like the story. I like how it's kind of presented in, like, communications between crew members and all that stuff. And the writing is kind of funny, actually. But I kind of like how you weave in kind of what happened in the first game into the exposition of this game.
Yeah.
Like, they attacked 7 years ago. That must have been what happened in the first game. You know, that's what I was thinking. And I thought that was pretty clever. How was that conscious from the get-go, or that just kind of happened naturally?
Well, that's what immediately set me looking for the first game. Because I was like, oh, wait, this is a sequel. And then I went hunting for the first one.
Yeah, I think Anthony, who did the writing, he did a really great job with it. And what he wanted to do was, go back a little bit. Compared to a lot of other games, we probably didn't have as much many tools in our arsenal, I suppose, for getting the story across as what we might have. We're a small team, you know, pretty limited budget, that kind of stuff. So. But what Anthony wanted to do was try and give the game a feeling of actually being in a world, introducing lore that gives characters background and, you know, gives a feeling of of this being an actual place, but you know, obviously had some limited tools to do that, like the story exposition through dialogue and you know, some of the events that pop up when you're on the mission selection screen, that kind of stuff. So I think referring to the previous game wasn't so much about, well, I guess what it was about was trying to make the world seem as real as we could, like it has a history, all of the characters have their background stories, have their own personalities, their own styles and so on.
Right.
It's just really about giving more depth to the world that it's set in, which in turn means that when you're doing the missions, there's a reason why you're doing it. It's not just a series of skirmishes that are connected by blocks of text. You know, you're going to this particular place because you know, something happened and there's a person you need to talk to or whatever. So it just makes it feel more real, more deep, more interesting, I guess.
Yeah. And that really does work because the characters felt fairly real. They had distinct voices, which I liked.
Yeah.
And so, like, this one guy's a dick to your main character. This one guy likes your main character. But, you know, he's kind of loyal anyway. And then you have this commander guy who's just a dick in general. And I just kind of like that.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. I mean, some characters, you know, it's okay to like them. And some characters, they can't not like them very much. And that's completely fine. Yeah.
Now, one thing I wanted to really ask about are the ships. I've gotten maybe 11 or 12 missions in so far, and I've gotten to play with maybe three or four different ships, the Raider, the Corvette, the Frigate, and the Destroyer.
Yep.
And I love how, like, kind of different they all are. Like, if I'm remembering correctly, the Frigate is the one with primarily the side arcs.
Correct.
And then the Destroyer has kind of a has three arcs, side and front, and the Corvette has a front and rear arc, and I kind of love how that makes you kind of work different. Like you can't just have everyone stay in a certain, like in videos people were telling me, oh Brian, you have to stay in formation. I'm like, this doesn't work with these different ships, guys. I can't keep them all in a specific formation because they have different arcs. But I like that they have different arcs because they have different like uses. Like this guy's going to go here. Let's get him in a pincer between the two arcs of our Frigate and our Destroyer. And I love that. So how much work went into the design of each individual ship and its usefulness?
Yeah, quite a bit. I think what we've sort of done there to a degree, not completely the same, but we've done to a degree is we've sort of looked at maybe like an RPG system, maybe like a party system where you have different. So you've got like a fighter, a cleric, all that kind of stuff. And so each ship has a particular, a role to play. And so then we've kind of designed what its weapons are and, you know, its armaments and so on based around that. So, the Raider, you know, obviously small, nimble, fast. The Frigate, one of my favorite ones to play with, it's very much about, defense. So it's got really tough shields. Its weapons aren't great, but what it's got is a stun beam. So you can, you know, you don't kill things, but you stop them. It's got the countermeasure system, which is great for, you know, anti-missile and, you know,
use that a lot. I use that quite a bit.
So like each particular ship is designed to have a particular role. And I guess part of the when you're exploring the game and figuring, working it out and learning it is working out how to use each one to its maximum effect.
Yeah.
And then if you do that, then that will make a big difference to your play experience.
So far, my favorite, I think, is the Corvette so far. It's just she does a good amount of damage in the front and the rear. And it's a versatile, it's got missiles, it can turn real fast.
Yeah, I mean, the key word for the Corvette is versatile. It's kind of like the default sort of ground troop type thing. So it can do everything. It doesn't particularly excel in any one particular thing, but, it's just an all-rounder.
Which I like. I like all-rounders, and it's a really it's a real handy ship to have when you lose a Raider, for example. Like the last battle I played, I saved my reinforcement points and got a second Corvette, and it really helped turn the tide, you know, because I just love the Corvette. So I lose Raiders a lot too.
Yeah, you got to keep them moving. Yeah.
Yeah, and one thing I found out the hard way that your game has that some games like this don't is ramming. I kind of hate you for that. Not really. But when I first saw a couple ships around, I'm like, what? Oh, no. Shit, I didn't even think of that. Because, you know, a lot of games like this, they, like, have the magic, oh, we're just going to magically pass over it. Like, didn't Starfleet Command do this where they just magically don't hit each other? They just magically pass over and under each other and not actually hit. So I think that's where my brain was. But then when I had two ships hit, it's like, oh, crap. And then my one ship couldn't, like, do anything for a whole turn. It's like, son of a bitch.
So, I mean, that there's ramming when you mean to and there's ramming when you don't. So, I mean, you can actually use that as a tactic as well.
I bet. Now, one thing I also wanted to ask about is the war scale, because there's a bit of confusion around that from people I've talked to and a little bit myself. So it seems like the war scale – some people have told me the war scale rises and falls one way or another based on your energy settings. Is that true or is there another way? Is there a different way it works?
That's one factor. There's a formula that we use to calculate that in each mission. And there's a whole bunch of different factors that are involved. Energy settings is one of them, but also, you know, there's a lot of other things that you put into it as well. So I guess the basic idea of the war scale is that it's, so there's a battle going on, there's a war going on, and you're playing one small part in that. And so the war scale is your effect on the overall battle, the overall war. And so as you go through missions, it's looking at your actions and your play style. And then it gives you calculates a score, and then based on that score, it kind of gates certain story arcs, certain chapters of the story. And so depending on what ones are available and which ones are not, you could play the game through twice and have completely different stories from beginning to end.
And that's pretty cool. I do have to admit I like that.
So
far I seem pretty aggressive, so I saw there's a mission I couldn't even take because it was on the defensive side of things.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
What are the rules? Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think something that, because, I mean, it's a fairly new system, and I can't think of another game that's done something like this. Maybe not doing a very good job of explaining how it works.
The closest thing I can think of are the infamous games where you have a good meter and an evil meter. That's the closest thing I can think of. But, like, I was going to ask, what are, like, the general rules of thumb to go more on one side or the other? Like, how do you have to behave to go more on one side or the other during your mission?
So I guess if you're the more careful you are with not losing ships, whether it's your ships or ships you're escorting, if you sort of use missiles from a distance rather than getting in close and using like high power weapons, you're more likely to go towards a defensive war scale. If you use more sort of like, you know, get in there, bash around and, you know, all power to weapons, all that kind of stuff, like, you know, that sort of thing, then you're more likely to get an aggressive force.
Okay, that kind of makes more sense because people were telling me it's just the power. And I'm like, it can't just be that. That doesn't make any sense. So I'm glad to hear there's more to it than just where you place your power triangle.
Yeah, there's definitely more. I mean, and having said that, we're kind of, you know, keeping an eye on those discussions and stuff. And, you know, we might look at maybe we need to tweak it a bit and we'll see how we go.
And another question I have that's raised some confusion, and I was hoping for some clarification, are I believe when you there's a crew section for your ship where if you have multiple crew members – excuse me, you can drag different lines between them. This is actually just on the stream. You can drag different lines between them and you get certain bonuses for, say, your flagship or your fleet. Yeah. But people were saying it's not clear why those work the way they do. So are those like character stats that are working?
Yeah. So what's happening there is that as you go through the game, you collect characters that
are
part of your bridge crew, your flagship. And each character is, you know, they've got their own, kind of set of skills, like sort of passive skills.
Right.
And you can activate either an aggressive or a defensive version of each one of those skills. So you might have someone who's a specialist, and so if you activate their aggressive character traits, then you're going to get bonuses to weapons. If you do their defensive ones, then you get maybe a bonus to shields or something like that. So that's on one layer. You've got the different characters on the bridge, with some small like passive buffs. Then on top of that, each character, they interact with each other because they've all got their own personalities. And then that gives your overall crew a mood, how they're all feeling. And if they're all happy with each other, then you'll get a bonus for your flagship. And if they're not happy with each other, then you get a bonus, but it's less. So it kind of works on a couple of different levels. One is the individual crew members, but also the interactions, how they interact together, gives another bonus to your flagship.
Oh, okay. So there's also kind of like a Jagged Alliance type thing going on here where you've got characters who might not like each other.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Wow.
Like the two first characters you get are Valor and Dice and Haven Jinx. They're not necessarily the best of friends. They're kind of a bit different than their personalities, so you need to be careful which of their abilities you activate. And depending on which ones you activate, then it's how they're going to relate to each other. Which I guess the thinking behind that system is if you look at sort of any sort of science fiction or most sort of science fiction in like outside of games, like movies and TV shows and stuff.
Mm.
There's all this really cool visual effects and that sort of stuff, but it was also a lot of the time there's more about character dramas and interactions between different people on the bridge. And
true.
So we kind of thought, like, can we take some of that kind of aspect of sci-fi? Like, can we bring that into our game somehow? And that's kind of the system that we've built.
Was that? I don't think that was me.
No, that was me.
Okay. That's all right. I was just like, what? Is that me? So that explains that a lot better. So basically it's offensive and defensive and you could tweak it back and forth and that might actually change how they, wow.
Mm.
This game is a lot deeper than even I thought.
Yeah, well, I hope so. We've been working on it for quite a while. So yeah, it's just, I guess some of these things, when you kind of described as a space combat game, maybe not immediately what you think of straight away, but just trying to add some innovations and some new things to the genre.
No, I mean, definitely. I mean, like I said, it reminded me not only of games I love, like Starfleet Command and, Over the Reich, but it also has its own flair to it, which I really kind of adore. And there are, 60 missions you can go through? Roughly around 60-ish missions?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, about 60. In any given playthrough, you're not going to go through all those because some of them will be blocked off depending on your war scar. You probably do maybe sort of 25 to 30 on a playthrough.
That's a good playthrough because I noticed the further I'm getting in the campaign, the longer they're getting. Like the first few were only like 15, 20 minutes. And then second few, the like 12, 13 in, you're like one battle for 40 minutes. It's like, oh my God, there's so many aliens. Help me.
It gets so much worse.
I'm not complaining. That's great. Yeah. But that denotes that the, even your first playthrough will be fairly lengthy.
Yeah. And hopefully, people will enjoy it and get a lot out of it. I mean, that's kind of why we do it. So, yeah.
Now, are there, I don't know if this is proper, but are you guys planning any kind of more content coming, like maybe an expansion, DLC, that kind of thing? Because I'm sure once I get to a certain point and finish or whatever, I'm going to want more. And skirmish will only do enough.
Yeah. Look, we certainly have many ideas for where we could go with this story. I mean, we built a pretty robust engine, and we can do a lot with it.
And it looks great too, by the way. I mean, you said it's based on Unity, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It looks really like it runs super fluid. I mean, it looks great. One thing I liked that I found by accident is that if you zoom in on the ships, they get louder, that's just a little thing. I love little things like that. So like you zoom in on one of your fighters, like, oh, wow, I could hear its engines. Wow, suddenly. So I just love little things like that.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of really nice touches.
Yeah, something like that's actually pretty straightforward to do when you've got a game engine like Unity. Just attach a sound to an engine and then give it a fall off, and then it just works. So it's pretty cool. Yeah.
So how many? Based on where I'm in the campaign, I have up to 5 ships in a mission with me. How many can you have max? I'm 6 or 8. I'm just curious.
You have 8 ships is your maximum number of command points when you get to the last couple of chapters.
Okay.
So basically, depending on what flagship you've got a number of command points, which is how many ships you can have. And I think, it starts at 3 and it goes up to 8 when you have the Dreadnought as your flagship.
So does each ship count 1 point regardless of size? Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But generally, you'll only have like one, whatever the flagship is, you only have one of that type and you have whatever you want underneath that.
Well, another thing I like is that you give options not just for auto fire, but targeted fire as well. But the auto fire does a pretty good, like I never really had to change it because it does a good job of it seems to do a good job of choosing the right targets to shoot at. So it seems like there's a good mix of I have control over the ship, but the AI is still doing something.
Yeah.
You know, the AI is still handling the guns and repairs and such. So, how much work went into the AI, and is the AI for the Nautilid also fairly fleshed out? Because they have different ships too that do different things, and they also seem to know when to use their benefits as well. Like, what's that one? Are they called the Sappers or something? Where they have this energy thing that like steals all your energy.
Yeah, the disruptors. Yeah.
Yeah, disruptors. Thank you. And I hate those things. So I didn't think they'd be a problem at first. And then I'm like, wait a minute. Why am I having all these energy? Son of a bitch. So I didn't realize how much of a problem they actually were until I was in the thick of it. How much work went to the AI for both you got for your ships? Cause there's AI there and the enemy as well. Cause it seems pretty robust.
Yeah, it's good to hear. The AI for your ships is pretty straightforward. It's just some fairly simple algorithms for, you know, find the closest enemy, So with your fire mode, you're going to auto-fire, but by default it's going to shoot at the closest thing. Or you can tell it to override with, you know, shoot at the biggest thing or the strongest thing.
Right. I was trying to remember that. Because I play a lot of games and I didn't want to sound like an idiot and say, is this game or is this another game that does this? But you can check. I like how you can select a weapon and say, you fire at the weakest thing and you fire at the closest thing. It's really clever.
Yeah, that's cool. And that sort of came about because, different weapons, like a smaller weapon is more accurate but does less damage. The bigger weapons are less accurate but do more damage, right? So it might probably make sense, maybe, you know, give way too many hints and stuff, but it probably makes sense if you've got a bigger weapon to shoot at something that's a bit bigger and stronger rather than shooting at something that's small and nimble. So that way, that's why we put that hint system in place so that you can have control over being able to, you know, use that auto fire to the best effect. The AI for the Nautilids evolved a lot. Again, like the movement system I was talking about before, it's something where you sort of start out with it and then they do some things and you see how it goes, and then, okay, well, they're really dumb. They keep making this mistake or that mistake, and you just iterate, just evolve over time. There's no sort of secret formula, anything like that. Right. It's just a question of you work out what you want them to do, you implement that, you try it out, you see how they work. If they start doing things that don't make sense, you fine-tune the algorithm and stuff and just keep going. I think I've got written about 3 times from where we write something, scrap it, start again, write it, start again.
Oh, wow. So that's not like, so you guys said you worked on this game for at least a couple of years. How long did you, was this game in production? How many people were working on it? Not like how big's the company and everything.
From when we first decided to do it to release was approximately 20 months.
Oh, wow. Almost 2 years.
Yep. And, there was basically, there's like a main core team of three of us, and we've also had probably about another four or five people contribute in different ways along the way.
Wow.
There was,
so wait, I'm sorry, this game took less than 2 years to make with a core team of only three people.
Yeah. And
wow.
Some of them as well.
I got to say that is super impressive because this, it's just really just, it feels all, it does not feel like an indie title or, you know what I mean when I say that?
Yeah.
Like certain games, you know, you could tell, oh, it's an indie game. You're just like, it's indie, you know, obviously. This
does
not.
Pretty well polished, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. This does not feel or look like you just, I show people, like, when I started playing, I showed people screenshots of how the map looked with the grids and the firing arcs and all the, you know, the lines that show the elevations and everything for the enemies and you guys. And people were like, ooh, I want that. I'm like, yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Yeah, I guess my only complaint about the game is it doesn't really take the Nautilid's feelings into account because I think, you know, that if we had just had a conversation with
them. Come on, man.
Like, why are they so angry? Who shot first?
It's probably like the guys from Space Above and Beyond. We never learned why they were so angry either.
Yes, we did. You didn't watch the end of the show? You're so busted. Yeah, the last episode. Yeah. We'll find out. Okay.
Really?
Yes. It was, it was because the moon that they landed on, it was one of their sacred things. And then they actually had found out that they shared the same base amino acid structure as humans. So they had determined, because they came from that moon. And then when we landed there, you know, they were like, no, you know, you can't be here because this is our sacred. This is the birthplace of our people.
Oh.
And then once they studied humans a little bit, they realized, like, we were chemically the same. And then they figured out, like, the it was basically from whenever Earth was forming or whatever. And then there was, like, an asteroid impact, and it carried, like, our DNA to their moon. And that's how they came about. So they were just like, oh, well, we're totally compatible with Earth. So we'll be moving in.
Oh, so, no.
Yeah. But the whole deal, they had that peace conference summit at the end where the one guy came and he turned himself in and he's like, no, we want to stop fighting because, you know, we understand something now. And that's, they were having the talk there, and they did that to get the guy that was in charge of that colony. It was basically like the corporate guy, you know, like how Paul Reiser was a dick in
Aliens.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. So they get that guy in there, and then he starts telling him, he's like, you knew. We told you. And the guy's like, no, I never, whatever. And he's like, no, we told you, and you still did this, and then you guys killed our people, and that's why the war. And then he, like, jumps through the – they had, like, a glass barrier separating them, jumps through there, and, like, pulls a dagger and stabs the guy. Yeah. So, spoilers.
Looks like I need to watch the last –
spoilers.
For some reason, I never got around to watching few episodes.
But the thing that's cool is they have a different atmosphere.
Ryan, you just never want it to end. We understand.
That's pretty much it.
Like, they have a different atmosphere than us, right? And it happens to be flammable. So when he jumped in to the other room, because it's like methane, right? When he jumped into the other room, of course, the atmospheres mix. And then one of the colonial guys pulls his pistol out and takes a shot, which causes like all the air in the room to explode. And kills all the diplomats. So, yeah, it was actually pretty intense at the end there.
Wow, I'm going to have to watch this again. I mean, it's a good excuse to rewatch the whole series, I guess.
Right, and a very similar thing happens in Mission 25. No, I'm kidding.
Damn it, Jim. Spoiling everybody tonight. What happened in the season finale of Game of Thrones last night? You want to tell everyone that? Go ahead.
Everybody died.
Yeah. I'm not going to talk about it.
You know, I didn't even watch it.
Daenerys flew away on a dragon. And,
oh.
Yeah.
And wait, she had a daughter named Astrid who on an island called Burke.
What?
So for those who are wondering what happened in the series season finale,
I don't really care.
Luke reconciles with his father.
And we found out that Han Solo was married all along.
The Emperor dies with the help, and the Empire falls with the help of some teddy bears, and everybody lives happily ever after. That's the season finale of Game of Thrones. Or Return of the Jedi. It's one of the two. I get this mixed up.
You know, ever since they killed Sean Bean, I just don't care about Game of Thrones anymore.
Sean Bean dies in everything he's in, so yeah, it doesn't matter.
Just about. I watched The Island the other day for the first time, and I'm like, whoop, there's Sean Bean. He's probably going to die. Yep.
Sorry, Paul. This is how we are. We digress sometimes.
We go off on tangents, Paul. Please feel free to join in. But anyway. So I was wrong about Space Above and Beyond. So I guess give us a hint. Do we find out, Paul, why the Nautilus are just so angry?
Yes.
Ooh, there you go, Jim. Yep. There you go. We find out.
It's the exact same plot from Space Above and Beyond.
No. Give them more credit than that. Though everyone does steal from everybody else. So
I guess we obviously do our best to make our own stuff, but everybody is influenced in some way, shape, or form by other things they like.
No one is accusing you guys of that.
we're just kidding.
We're just fucking around.
So I do have a question though about toward the end of the game, because I went and it's not like a super spoiler, because if you go into the skirmish mode and you set like a large fleet battle, you're going to see it anyway. But the enemy super huge unit, that thing, is that like the alien queen and there's one of
super
them
huge
or do you fight multiple? I know, right? Do you fight multiples of those, or is that like the end boss of the game?
So it depends on your story arc. In some ways you want to fight one, in other ways you'll fight several of them. But they're called monarchs, and they're very sort of high order, sort of boss type thing of the Nautilus Society.
Yeah, it's basically their super dreadnought kind of.
Yeah, they've got a lot
of hit points.
Yeah, I mean their role in the society is basically to they spawn units, they create all the Nautilus, so they're pretty important.
Yeah, so the Nautilids, do they have shields, or are they just meat and they don't heal up damage over time or something? Because it's shields will come back up.
Yeah. They have armor, depending on each one's different. Some of them have armor which reduces the amount of damage that you do on certain sides or top or bottom, whatever. They do heal, but slowly, because they're organic beings, so it's kind of rate would be. But then there's the healer, which is a variety that if the other Nautilus get close by, they'll heal very quickly.
Oh. Is there a happy ending where you make friends with the Nautilids? And
if you want to be
friends. I mean, they want more games. I can't imagine they don't want more games out of this. So,
well,
I
know, but it's like Hunter and I have been playing Ark. And you can, you start the game running from the dinosaurs, and you end the game putting a saddle on the dinosaurs. So I just figured, maybe we can saddle up that monarch and like ride it into the sunset. I don't know. It's just me.
Is that good?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Really? Even with the pooping element?
That's kind of random. I'm glad that people don't really just unexpectedly like, oops, sorry about that, Just drop the deuce in the middle of the room, like in mid conversation. But yeah, it's
really
very
random.
Weird.
You're running and you like shit your pants. Apparently,
wrong. Yeah, you'll just you're walking along and then, and it puts a little you defecated on the screen. And it's like, why is this even here? Why does it matter? Why do I need to know?
Because
the dinosaurs defecate.
All these survival games just have to be more and more.
We were building a hut, right? Like we're doing that, and a triceratops walks up and like just drops a bomb right next to it, and it's like, thanks.
Well, apparently though, you have to take it and you can use it for fertilizer.
That's what I read. I read that. Yeah. already could use that for fertilizer.
Right, and then
but other than the poop element, it's actually shaping up to be a pretty good game.
You can. I wish that you could actually take the dinosaur poop and make like a snowman out of it. And but no.
Just watch. They will add that. They will eventually. They will eventually add that. So is there going to be poop in Fubisher Starhammer? No, I'm kidding.
Well, actually, well, the aliens. If you hit the aliens, Monarch
start
hard
dropping
enough,
poop.
Then
that's what the aliens. That's what the Nautilids are shooting you with. Is their poops?
They're sort of space yeah. monkeys in that way. Yes.
You son of a bitch! Yeah!
That was the time.
Oh, that's great. Oh, sorry. So this came out, what, about 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, 4th came out, so yeah, almost 2 weeks.
And I don't know if this is appropriate to ask or not, but how is it doing? Is it doing well?
Oh, it's doing well. We're happy with the response so far. Got some pretty good reviews on Steam, and most of the media reviews have been pretty positive, so we're happy about that. We're getting some players, so I'm very happy with how it's all going. Yeah.
Oh no, that's very good because it's when I first saw there. This is a tangent. When I first saw they were going to do Steam reviews, I'm like, oh, this is going to suck. This is going to suck. This is going to be terrible. People are just going to write a bunch of bullshit. But no, they're actually super useful.
Because
people actually seem to give a shit about what they... I mean, I've heard of a few games here and there getting review bombed, apparently. But for the most part, people write decent stuff in here. And you could also, because you could see how long they've played, you're like, oh, this guy's played for 15 hours and he gave it a good review. That's a good sign, you know? So it's amazing how useful these become. And yeah, you guys have, let's take a look right now.
One of my favorite things is every now and then you'll see the guy who's got like 200 hours in a game and he's got like a one line sentence saying this game's crap and negative or whatever. And like, you're like, why'd you play it for so long if it's that bad?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Played 1500 hours. Not recommended. Yeah.
Like what?
1500 hours. Not recommended.
There are 28 positive reviews and 3 negative reviews. That's not bad. That's actually pretty good. And there are actually a bunch of people playing it. There are 15 people playing it right now. Right? Ow. What was... Yeah. Ow. Hello?
Hello?
What was that?
Sorry, answering machine. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I was like, what the heck is that? But, yeah, you've got at least 20 people playing it today. That is, you know... Average playtime, 11 hours. This is what Enhanced Steam tells me anyway. That's pretty good.
I mean, and that, as a developer, like that's really exciting. Like we're so, just really excited that people are playing this thing that we've spent all this time making. It's just awesome.
Oh, that's true. Cause you guys, you know, you put all your heart and soul in this. You put almost for 2 years. It must be just so gratifying to see. Not only the positive reviews, but the play time and everything that people are playing it for, you know, 11 hours, you know, and there 1,000 to 3,000 people have played it just in the last 2 weeks, you know, and that's, you know, that is nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah, look at my hour count on the game.
Well, Jim, you don't count.
Why?
You told me why.
Oh. Yeah, for some reason the game didn't exit Steam. The game was out, but Steam still insisted that I was playing it. So I have like 100 hours in the game because I went that long before I rebooted. Yeah,
76.7.
Well, there you go. So I look like your biggest fan at this point.
Yeah,
so
okay.
We'll let that
100 hours and that's not sad.
Would you say there's 100 hours here with the branching campaign and everything?
Oh.
Or is that an unfair question? Because not every game should provide 100 hours, and not every game can provide 100 hours.
Well, the nice
hours,
thing
so that
is
that
it's got
question.
Replay, because you can go back
that's
through
true.
And do things
that's
different.
That's what I was thinking. You can play the campaign more than once and maybe get different missions plus the skirmish mode. That's what I was thinking.
So I kind of hesitated a bit. It's definitely theoretically possible if you wanted to do that. If you played it, and it depends on how quickly you play through the campaign as well, because like some people might be guns and they'll just, you know, get it straight away and they'll just play it through. Other people might be a lot more deliberate and careful how they play and stuff, and so their game will take longer, they do more planning. So it's going to vary fairly considerably. So theoretically, it's possible that you could spend 100 hours, for sure.
And I kind of like how the game rewards both play styles with, you know, oh, this mission, because you were very careful, you can play this particular mission, you know. But you were an aggressive guy that ran into the fight, so you can only play this mission.
Mm.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Story goes in a way that suits that kind of play style. So.
Right. But I'm just, I've got a bunch of friends who own the game, and I got one, someone's played it for 15 hours. Daz 24680, because he's from Australia as well, and apparently that's how you say it over there, Daz. He's got about 18 hours in it, which is pretty, not shabby at all. So yeah, it's definitely striking a chord with people, which is good.
Oh, it's very cool. It makes us very happy.
And I'm just happy that there are more good space, because I mean we're kind of in a resurgence of space games right now, which is great. But with that resurgence, there does come some shit along with that resurgence. So it's always good to see a good quality game come out that people will enjoy for a while. I played a bunch of hours with it for my Let's Play, and I tell people at the end of my series whether I'm going to keep playing it or not. Mm-hmm. And this is definitely a game I'm going to keep playing in my off time, because it's just fun.
Awesome. Very cool.
So future plans. We already talked about possible DLC. Are there any like patches coming out? Anything that's like, oh god, we should have fixed that? Kind of thing.
Yeah, we've done one patch that fixes up some bugs, and that should be out pretty soon.
Oh, good.
With the publishers at the moment, so hopefully that'll be out pretty soon.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah, because I
just a few other things from the initial.
I don't know about you, but Steam has a thing. You know, it's like tells you how many downloads you've had, and like it'll show you which games have been updated, and like that's like Christmas for me. It's like, oh, all these games have been patched. I wonder what they added.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't Steam start out as a download and patching system for Counter-Strike or something?
Say again?
I thought Steam like actually started out as a download and patching system for Counter-Strike.
Is that true? It just started out as a patching system?
I think so, yeah.
And now it was like
the delivery mechanism for just the source games, really. Yeah, you know, it was like Counter-Strike and Half-Life 2.
Right, I remember buying the orange box because all of my friends were telling me about Portal.
Well,
like I should play this, and it said I had to download this thing called Steam. Like, what the fuck is this? Why do I need
Steam?
This?
Steam came out with Half-Life 2.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. That was it.
So it was before the orange box came out, and it was Half-Life 2, and everybody hated it. It was like super stupid. No one really liked it. And then, about a year after that, it started getting really interesting. And obviously here we are today.
Right.
Yeah. But it was a considerable length of time that, first off, there was nothing but Valve products on it. And then for years it was like they only let the most select AAA titles in, you know, that. And at some point then some like indie stuff started to leak in, and then suddenly the floodgates just popped open. So
2004 was when Half-Life 2 was released in November. Oh, so
Steam is that old.
Just over 10 years.
Cause I remember when I first bought, like the first thing I really bought on Steam was, a collection of the original XCOM games, I think. Mm-hmm. And I was like, really? All this for like $9? What? This is ridiculous.
Yeah, the XCOM games, the Orange Box, the Valve. I remember when the Valve Complete Collection was relatively cheap on a sale one day, and I got all that. That was the early days. And now I'm over 1,100 games in, and so, yeah.
I'm catching up to you, you son of a bitch.
Slowly, hey, look, but if surely. You want to spend more money than me, great, go for it.
You're moving, so I have a good excuse. Because I'm not. I moved this time last year, so I get it. But, yeah. So yeah, it's just kind of amazing. And it's kind of funny because for a while, Slytherin wasn't even on Steam. Like you kind of came in at the right time because for like ages, you couldn't even find their games on Steam until like the last year.
Yeah, I think it's probably last year or so from my understanding. Yeah.
And it's like, it seems to be working really well for them.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I guess I can't really sort of speak for them and for other games.
Right,
but yeah, no, it definitely does seem to be, yeah.
And they're a good crew over there too. We got to go to an event of theirs. What was that, 2 years ago, Jim? A couple years ago now.
Yeah, I think it was summer before last. So yeah.
Yeah, so I think almost 2 years ago. Yeah, we got to go to an event of theirs, and we got to meet Ian and all of them, and they were just a really quality group of folks who really seemed to care about their game. So has it been a good process for you guys? Like, how did you even get on with Matrix and Slytherin in the first place? Because you self-published the first game, it looks like, right?
Yeah. And you know, to be blunt, the first one didn't sell particularly well. And I guess what I realized is that I'm a developer, not a marketer, and that I probably needed a bit of help with that. So when we were developing, in the early days of developing this game, we were sort of thinking about, you know, who could we work with that would be a good match for the particular game we were trying to make. And so we drew up a bit of a list of who that might be and made some approaches. And, this is what turned out. They've been pretty helpful or very helpful along the way. Given us a lot of, you know, good advice about some of the things in the game, which we could maybe things we needed to add, which we hadn't thought about or various changes and stuff. So it's been pretty good in that respect. And here we are.
No, that's great because, in the past couple of years, not only have they gone on Steam, but they've also started varying their catalog a bit more, like with this and with, the Warhammer game and with Hell. And, I mean, they had like Distant Worlds and the Starships Unlimited. They had the random mass space game every so often. But, you know, it was mostly the war game stuff, which, you know, that's great. But it's really great to see them doing more space games because I actually like interacting with those guys. So I'm like, yeah, I can actually talk to you about this. Because they send me press releases for all the stuff they do. I'm like, nope, can't do it. Nope. Oh, look, a space game. Yes, I could talk to you about this, Oliver. That's great. Because I like Oliver. He's great. So, I'm really glad that's working out for you guys, because I'm sure having a publisher definitely made some things easier on you.
Yeah, without question. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Like what does having a separate publisher take off your plate from when you publish yourself?
Pretty much means that we can just focus on developing the game and not have to worry about trying to market the game.
Because
I think, you know, like making it is only part of the story, and actually getting it out to the players is a really big effort. There's a lot of work involved in that.
Right.
And I think it's where a lot of sort of independent companies sort of fall down is they don't put enough effort into the marketing of their products. And then they don't get the players, and then it doesn't work out. So just by being able to focus on developing means that we can do a better job of making the game, and then they can do what they do, which is to, you know, put out the press releases and set up the Steam store page and hand out all the review codes, all those kind of tasks. that if we were trying to do those things ourselves as a small team, like, we'd be overwhelmed with the amount of work that's required. And also that's going to be detracting from us actually working on the game as well. So it's kind of complementary, and it just means that there's a whole part of the process of getting the game from idea to, you know, product in people's Steam library that we don't need to worry about.
So that's kind of one of the reasons why this game might be a little more robust than the first.
I'd say so, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Is that, yeah, just we just focus on making the best game we possibly can. We don't need to worry about anything outside of that.
Well, I gotta say, I think you guys have succeeded, because I gotta say this game was surprising, because I heard of the first game, I never played it, so I was like, okay, I'll give this a shot. I got it, the beta. Whoa! What the hell is this? I was very pleasantly surprised.
Yeah,
first time I played it. So I've been trying to sing its praises to people, and hopefully it's working, because people are like, ooh, that looks great.
I mean, it's really motivating when we see people like yourself, you know, talking about the game and that you like it. It's super motivating, it's super inspiring, so it's great.
Yeah, and we definitely want to see more out of you guys. So folks, go buy this. God, is it on sale right now? Shit, I found, hang on. I'm not sure. Just let me double check. It is not part of the Steam sale right now, but that's okay. It's worth $20. It is worth $20 for all the content you get. It's at least, you're going to get at least twice that much in hourly play with multiple campaign playthroughs and skirmish mode. So this game is definitely worth $20, people. And it's on Steam right now. Starhammer, The Vanguard Prophecy. We should probably start wrapping this up. Anyone?
Yeah,
I'm gonna
go get Starhammered right now.
I just spit all over my nice new microphone. Thank you, Jim. poor little Mike. But yeah, Paul, I want to thank you so much for taking the time, because again, you're in Australia, so it's mid-morning for you. Are you working right now? Do you work from home? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, I am. Well, working insofar as today's, yeah, just going to look at if there's any bugs I need to fix, and planning out what we're going to do from now on. So, yep.
Okay, because I really appreciate, like I was saying before the show, it's nice to not have to get up at 5 in the morning. To talk to someone overseas, because as much as I love doing that, I'm not at my best that early in the morning.
I'm grateful it's not 2 o'clock in the morning, because that's not my best time.
So I really appreciate you being flexible on the time. And folks, again, the game is Starhammer, The Vanguard Prophecy. I just did a 6-part Let's Play series of it on the site. You can go check it out on youtube.com/spacegamejunkie. Also just want to throw out, I do have a Patreon, folks, for the site. We're not far from a officially rented TeamSpeak server. Just a few more donations needed for that. So check that out. I believe it's patreon.com/Hunter. You're quiet for most of the goddamn show, and now you fucking choose to. Anyway.
No, I'm just excited. Like, that's awesome, guys. Seriously, a TeamSpeak server for Space Game Junkie, that's going to be awesome. Please help us get to that.
Yeah, head to patreon.com. I believe it's patreon.com. I should know this. It's patreon.com/spacegamejunkie.
Does that mean you're going to start paying me to run that server?
No. We're gonna rent an official one.
So I'm not good enough.
Not saying you're not good enough. I feel more comfortable giving someone else's login.
You feel more comfortable giving someone else money. I understand. It's okay.
I feel more comfortable giving a person who I might not know that well or at all a login to, say, a rented server rather than a computer in your living room. You know, that's that.
That's okay.
That's where that comes from. I don't feel really comfortable giving them that. So right. I'd rather have something a little more official.
If you guys want the web address, just message me. Just kidding. Don't do that. I'm not going to give it to you.
It's teamspeak.kittenhumper.com. That is kitten Humper, one word, .com. No, I don't even know if that's a thing. I just made that up. But, Paul, thank you so much for talking. Next week, folks, we're going to have the developers of Close Order to talk to about their shooty, roguey thing. So stay tuned for that, and we will see you next week. Thanks, everyone, for watching and listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.